This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we first hear from a professor of education on how the growing banning of books, censorship of teachers, and clampdown on student protest works to the benefit of those who would lead our nation into fascism.
We speak with Professor Henry Giroux, one of the great educators in North America, about his hopefulness in the student movement finding allies throughout the broader society.
We have another in our series of shows about fascism by talking to Diane Feeley, a labor historian and activist, about the consequences of unions in the U.S. continuing to place their workers' fate in the two major political parties.
She argues that doing so has not served their members well, has led to a growing fascistic divide in America, and that what is needed is a true workers' party.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Fascist Germany's industrial murder of Jews in Europe 80 years ago has been seared into the consciousness of humankind. Today, it's a great irony of history that the Israeli government, which claims to be the moral legatee of the Holocaust, is carrying out a genocide against millions of Palestinians in Gaza. This is being done with the full support of the American government, which supplies political, diplomatic, and propaganda cover for what Israel is doing. It supplies the bombs, planes, artillery shells, tanks, and bulldozers to physically destroy the buildings and infrastructure of the Gaza Strip. The people who live there have been systematically starved as the Nazis starved the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto. The response of American students in college campuses across the country was magnificent. Tent encampments sprung up in several hundred places. They became the focal point for a full-throated discussion of the realities in Gaza and American complicity in the ongoing genocide. Demands for ceasefire were raised, demands that the universities divest themselves of investments in Israel and American arms manufacturers were put forward. Sadly, this manifestation of critical thinking came to a crashing end. The wealthy and their servants in Congress and in the mass media accused the students of being anti-Semitic and of supporting terrorism. Congressional hearings were held. University presidents were fired. Professors lost their jobs. Students were expelled from schools. The great campus uprising was closed down. To talk to us today about education, fascism, and democracy is Professor Henry Giroux. He currently holds the McMaster University Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest in the English and Cultural Studies Department of McMaster College in Canada, and is the Pablo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Creative Pedagogy. Henry Giroux has authored many books, most recently with Anthony DiMaggio, titled Fascism on Trial, Education and the Possibility of Democracy. Professor Henry Giroux, a hearty welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, Henry, with the suppression of the Palestine Solidarity Movement on campuses, is it fair to say that the campuses have been turned into the American Homeland Security campuses?
I think it's fair to say that. I mean, I think in many ways what we're seeing, particularly in light of the protests against Israel and its slaughter of the Palestinian people, is we're seeing that the question of free speech is now being responded to, not by dialogue or an attempt to sort of understand the issues or to give students an opportunity to narrate themselves, but students are now met with snipers, checkpoints, violent police crackdowns, and in many ways, I mean, what we're seeing is militarized policing as a response to dissent. I mean, my argument is that what's happening on campuses in the United States, and in some cases, a number of other countries, is that the role of education as a democratic public sphere is being challenged in ways unlike we've ever seen before. I mean, all of a sudden we have billionaires who are basically supporting repressive policies, and we have the military basically being called in, the police, to suppress dissent. Students are being beaten, faculty are being arrested. I've never seen anything like this since the 1960s, and I think it's fair to say that as Michael Golwatovsky has argued, that what we now have is the American Homeland Security Campus. That the notion of oppression is not just simply around censorship, it's basically about the beating of bodies and the arresting of protesters and the reliance upon the military, the reliance upon the police to turn the campus into a police precinct. So it's pretty hard not to assume that something radical has changed with respect to questions of academic freedom and dissent, particularly when the dissenters, the protesters, have really expanded the nature of their own critiques. They're not just against the war in Gaza and of course increasingly in Lebanon. They're against the university in some ways suppressing free speech and investing in the war machine. That's dangerous.
Henry, let's talk about public education overall in the country today, if we can. Public education, it seems to me, and you've just been talking about one aspect of it, but at a broader level, it's under attack in the form of banned books, erased history, if certain parts of our history are even reported on in the textbooks anymore, the form of banned books, erased history, as I say, and the suppression of dissent, as you've already pointed out. You've written that education is never really neutral anyway. It's always a political act. And you wrote that it either serves to, well, liberate or domesticate, to either empower or to subjugate. Talk to us about that.
I mean, I think it's very clear that education is always political. There's no such thing as neutral education. Power is never not related to education in the form of the way the curriculum is produced, the way funds are allocated, the way the public and higher education function as sorting machines. But I think the real issue here is that education is central to political struggle because it's a means of fostering particular forms of agency, self-reflection. It basically functions in a way to legitimate certain conceptions of the self, their relationship to other, history, and how we view the future. And so I think in that way, when you talk about, for instance, banned books, censoring history, the suppression of labor, indiscriminate attacks on civic culture, all of these things suggest that education is a tinderbox, meaning that it either can function critically, educate students in a fundamental way to be informed, and to be critical thinkers and engage citizens. I think that what's really at stake here and what we have to understand, and it's crucial, is that you can't have a democracy without informed citizens. You can't have a democracy without institutions that nurture critical thought. And what we're seeing now, more than ever, in many ways, it's not just a form of McCarthyism. We're seeing an attack on any institution that in some way does two things, provides the economic conditions for these institutions to function, and in some way nurture their sense of critical inquiry. We're seeing that being eliminated. And we're seeing attacks on teachers. We're seeing attacks on educators who basically now are being fired if they somehow challenge the basic assumptions that drive a neoliberal, increasingly white Christian nationalist society.
Henry Giroux, please talk about your friendship with Pablo Freire, who he was, and why the two of you believed that democratizing education is the core of political resistance.
I mean, Paulo Freire was a Brazilian educator and a revolutionary of sorts. His seminal work was, of course, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which is really a kind of guide to understanding education as a tool for liberation, particularly in the face of forms of education that promoted particular types of illiteracy, denied people their history, didn't give them the skills to be able to read and write and think critically, prevent them from in some way examining what the conditions were that suppressed them. And of course, he organized a literacy campaign in the 1960s in Brazil, that was very empowering, and it gave people the opportunity to understand what it meant then to vote. In 1964, there was a military coup, and of course, Paulo was considered dangerous because, as one can say, like today, literacy is considered dangerous. The last thing that we want are people who basically can not only understand what democracy means, but basically can affirm its critical functions and enable it. Paulo and I became close friends in the 1980s, and we basically did everything we could to engage academics and young people and intellectuals in a way that would affirm the centrality of education to politics. We both believe that without a notion of critical education, you couldn't really take seriously what politics was about, because politics at its best, to say the very least, is about educating young people and others to understand the conditions under which they find themselves. And I think that in that sense, we had a books series for 15 years, publishing authors who basically could not get published in the mainstream press, and work together to basically inform and expand the concept of critical pedagogy, which in many ways has now become an international movement that's even more important in light of the ongoing suppression of public and higher education all over the world.
Let's talk now a bit about how we can get a handle on all of this. You say, for example, that we need to start by addressing certain concrete problems that people face. So tell us, first of all, what you see as these concrete problems, and then how do we then address them?
I think it's very clear we need to address the question of poverty. We need to address the question of a decent wage. We need to address what it means to people who have access to adequate and meaningful health care, free health care. We need to talk about free education. We need to talk about the meaningful jobs. We need to talk about what it means in some way to be able to create the conditions for people to challenge the rise of white Christian nationalism, an enormously deep-seated anti-intellectualism, and the erosion of civil rights. I mean, there are two arguments here. One is, what are the economic conditions that people absolutely have to have in order to have a life in which they don't have to make a choice between getting medicine and basically eating food or providing food for their children? And that means you need a meaningful wage, you need free health care, you need funds allocated for child care, you need a decent wage, a meaningful minimum wage. You need to in some way figure out how make power more equal. You need to democratize institutions in ways that it would seem to me would give people the opportunity to have opportunities that would enhance their ability to have a decent and meaningful life. On the other side, there's the ideological issue. And the ideological issue is, what do we do to expand the concept of democracy as a public good? What do we do to fight for democracy in ways that suggest there has to be a certain sense of the social contract? There has to be something that brings people together and connects them rather than divides them. What do we need to do educationally to attack the rise of systemic racism? But I think that for me, as an educator, one of the things that I find most crippling ideologically in light of this conversation is the notion that all problems are individual problems. We have no sense under neoliberalism of being able to translate private issues into larger systemic considerations. That's a massive form of depoliticization. It isolates problems, it blames people for the conditions under which they find themselves, and it normalizes enormous degrees of staggering inequality, the exploitation of the environment, a kind of rampant notion of self-interest, the demise of the social, the demise of the social state, and the rise of the punishing state. And so I think those two considerations have to be addressed. And these are very concrete issues, to say the least, because they bear down directly on how people live their lives, what their sense of individual and collective agency is, and how they understand themselves as being empowered to both address the conditions in which they find themselves and learn how to govern rather than be governed.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. I'm Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Jim Lafferty. We're speaking with Professor Henry Giroux. Henry, George Orwell understood that whoever controls education has the power to shape the future. The right in this country understands this profoundly, don't they? And they've taken concrete steps to gain control of the U.S. educational system, haven't they?
The right has always understood, not always, but since the 1970s, they've understood that the question of ideas and who controls the apparatuses that produces and legitimates those ideas. I mean, C. Wright Mills talked about the cultural apparatuses.
and what an important role they play in basically providing the theoretical political worldviews to which people understand themselves and operate. And I think that when you think back to the Powell memo of the 1970s, in which Powell said, hey, look, the right has to be engaged in the struggle for ideas. It needs to create, for the most part, think tanks. It needs to, in some way, be associated with universities. It needs to control the media. And I think all of that has happened. I mean, you know, five major corporations control 90% of all the media that's consumed in the United States. And I think that in some ways, their attack on public education, not just simply control over the social media with Google and all that's an X and all that sort of thing, which is another form of education, but they now are going after schools in ways, in public and higher education, in ways that we have never seen before. So I think they take the question of ideas seriously, not as a form of enlightenment, but basically as a form of suppression. They want to basically eliminate the possibility for a culture of thoughtfulness, informed citizens, critical thinking, an expansion of the imagination. They don't want to have anything to do with any of that stuff.
Well, and Henry, I mean, civics isn't taught anymore, for example, in the public schools. We could talk about that. But I want to ask you this. Why do you believe that the right wing's wish to whitewash history? To what extent is that really a precursor to fascism, if you will?
Well, I think that it seems to me that history can be dangerous because it can be enlightening. It can essentially reveal a whole range of injustices that need to be addressed if a democracy is going to fulfill itself. And I think that it is a precursor to fascism because by erasing the complexities of history and focusing, for instance, on racial purity and nationalism, it opens the door to authoritarian rule. It isn't a matter of just learning from history. It's a matter of understanding how history is always alive in the present. And that whoever controls that history in some way controls what it means to legitimate certain narratives over others, i.e., for instance, to control certain collective identities. When you erase the memories of Palestinian history, when you erase the memories concerning slavery and Jim Crow, when you erase how horrible capitalism has been over the last 50 years and destroying just about everything it touches, it normalizes the worst forms of domination. It makes people believe that they're inferior. It makes people believe they have no history, that history basically is only written by the victors, by those who have power. History is probably the most important pedagogical tool we have because historical consciousness doesn't just inform the present, it shapes the present. And it says something about the possibilities of the future not being the present.
Please talk about what you call a long-standing right-wing strategy to transform public and higher education into either corporate adjuncts or white Christian indoctrination centers.
I mean, look, there's been a particular transformation around schooling in the last 50 years, particularly since the late 1970s and the late 1980s. I mean, at one point, the issue was whether schools educate people to be democratic citizens or just workers. And that was the battle that went on for a long time. And the right basically did everything it could to turn education, particularly public education, into simply forms of training. I think that with 9/11 and the war on terror, the notion of education having a critical function came under attack in ways that we hadn't seen before. But I think what we see now is different. It's not just about suppressing education, critical forms of education. It's also about turning them into indoctrination centers, into centers to foster illiteracy, various forms of illiteracy, to foster white Christian nationalism, to foster a kind of highly extremist, corporatist mentality. It's a site that is now defined by three fundamentalisms: religious fundamentalism, economic fundamentalism, and political fundamentalism. So there's no attempt here in any way whatsoever the claim that education has to be defined through its claims on democracy, or that it should defend democracy, or that it should enable it. As a matter of fact, now the right defines education as something that has to be removed from democracy, and if anything, become a place where illiberal forms of democracy can be practiced. And it's in ways that we see in Hungary. You shape a curriculum to eliminate anything about trans people, you eliminate critical thought, you fire professors who are critical, and you shape the curriculum per se in the way that DeSantis wants to shape it, as simply a vehicle for the worst forms of propaganda.
And I wonder then, Henry, if you could please tell us as well, and especially our audience wants to hear this, I think, who was Primo Levi? And talk about his observation that every age has its own fascism, and that we see the warning signs wherever the concentration of power denies a country's citizens the possibility and the means of expressing.
What was so profound about him was that he didn't freeze the experience of Nazism in a particular historical moment. He said that every age has its own fascism, and it arises when power is concentrated to deny citizens their freedom. And he felt that with the erosion of democratic rights, the suppression of dissent, and the concentration of power in relatively few hands, what you end up with eventually are the camps. What you end up with is, at first, you suppress dissent, you suppress ideas, you kill the institutions that make them possible, you eliminate them, and then you kill the intellectuals and the poets and the cultural workers and the dissenters who make them possible. He saw a direct line between the suppression of dissent and basically the camp. And his argument was the elements of fascism take a different form in various societies, but the seeds are always there. And that you have to learn from history in order to recognize that.
Now, Henry Giroux, what does it mean to have a sense of hope in such dark times?
I think that, Michael, that's such a terrific question, because I think that without hope, there's no sense of agency. There's no sense of resistance. I think that when people can't imagine a future different from the present, there's no way to really understand that power is not just simply about domination, it's also about resistance. And that in every citadel and architecture of power, there are cracks, there are moments of resistance, there are possibilities. And without a sense of hope, you have no sense of agency. Without a sense of agency, you have no sense of hope. But I think that what we need to learn from this is that if you're going to have us, what the left and progressives need, they need to merge a sense of critique with a sense of possibility. And I want to make that concrete in that what I see happening today that around the question of criticism is that young people all over the globe are raising questions that basically expand and challenge issues that have become normalized for so long that they're now taken for granted. They no longer buy the assumption of common sense that capitalism is the only social order and social and economic order we can live in, that global capitalism can't be challenged, that justice doesn't matter, that protest is basically irrelevant in an age of mass suppression, that critical dissent doesn't have a place in a society that claims that there's no room for it. And I think that they're not only raising questions that basically have not been raised in the past or in the last 15 to 20 years, they're also working internationally with others across borders to basically try to understand how they can become a global force rather than just simply a national and limited social movement. Secondly, it seems to me that many of these social movements that operate off specific forms of oppression, whether we're talking about gender, the exploitation of women, the suppression of women's rights, or we're talking about the attack on civil rights around certainly black civil rights, or we're talking about poverty and those groups that are working to eliminate it and in some way address staggering forms of inequality, or climate activists, all of these groups increasingly realize they can't do this alone. They really have to connect with each other because these problems are connected. You can't talk about democracy and claim you're against the destruction of the planet around climate issues and be a racist. Democracy has a large expanse, a large umbrella. And it seems to me when we talk about political, economic, and social rights, as being absolutely central to what it means to live in a radical democracy or a democratic socialist society, these movements have to come together and fight for that. And then at the same time, of course, do everything they can to make us understand the particular forms of oppression that they talk about.
Last year on the college campuses, we saw an amazing uprising of protest against what Israel with the armaments of the U.S. is doing in Gaza. We saw, as you pointed out earlier in this show, though, a draconian crackdown on that right to dissent by the administrators of these colleges. Since that time, the rules restricting protests on college campuses has grown even and more severe and more strict. Are you nevertheless hopeful, given what we've seen the students do around this issue, that come this, and we are now back to school, that we'll begin to see those kinds of protests again, not only on the college campuses, but throughout our society?
No, I am hopeful. I think that what has happened is that the protests have moved now to a somewhat different level. Now it's clear that the militarization of the university, it's turned to forms of academic suppression and the violation of free speech and the firing of faculty, has really reached a new level of intensity, and is being expanded. And I think that what these groups are now doing is they're mobilizing in ways to sort of link those issues so that they're not just talking about the struggle over Palestinian sovereignty, which is paramount. They're also talking about how these institutions are now under the control of billionaires and a form of gangster capitalism that has to be addressed, that these issues can't be separated. And I think what young people are doing now are mobilizing both, not only on the campus in the most spectacular ways, but mobilizing off the campuses and trying to join with labor unions and others to begin to produce a movement that will have very concrete effects. You know, the old saying by Mario Savio in the 1960s is you've got to stop the machine. The dock workers stopped the machine. And I think that young people are starting to learn from that. The auto workers stopped the machine. And I think that what we need is a mass collective movement in which we're in the streets and we stop these institutions from working. They've got to be stopped. They just can't go on being controlled by a ruling elite that is heartless and cruel. The Elon Musk of the world. I mean, they're part of a larger financial class. And what that's called is neoliberal capitalism on steroids. And when it begins to fail and it can't legitimate its own arguments, it turns to force. It turns to fascism. And that's what we're seeing now.
Henry Giroux, Jim Laffin and I are extremely grateful for your articulation of the situation that we're in. We totally support your viewpoint. We're very, very happy to have you on Law and Disorder. We thank you so much. Thank you. How can people get in touch with you and follow your work?
I have a website, first of all, at Henry A. Giroux, no, just one word, .com. And also people can get in touch with me by Gmail, henry.giroux@gmail.com. And also I'm on Twitter.
That's Giroux, G-I-R-O-U-X. Thanks, Henry. You take it easy. We'd like to have you back. Been great to talk to you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Forces of the gathering authoritarian storm in our country are evident in many ways. It is manifesting itself in powerful and continuing nationalism, in disdain for human rights, in the entwinement of government and religion, in a controlled mass media, in the protection of corporate power and the suppression of labor power, and in the encouragement of violence. The power of labor has been channeled into the Democratic and Republican parties, the twin parties of capitalism. We need a workers' party, but we don't even have the nucleus of one. Race and gender are formative in the building of authoritarian regimes. We see this in the USA. Haitians who are black have been accused of eating cats and dogs. Women's rights to control their own bodies is under attack from the Supreme Court on down, and women are marked as childless cat ladies and told to stay home and bear children. We speak today with Diane Feeley on race and gender as formative in building authoritarian regimes and the potential power of our labor movement long buried in the clutches of the Democratic and Republican parties. Diane Feeley is an editor of the magazine Against the Current. She's a leader of Solidarity, a socialist feminist organization. Diane lives in Detroit, where she's been an activist for many years in the United Automobile Workers Union. Diane Feeley, a hearty welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks.
Diane, Chris Hedges, our previous guest, who inaugurated our series on fascism, what it is and how to fight it, is of the opinion that labor has to be central to protecting ourselves and to fight back. Why is this so?
Well, I agree with Chris on this. First of all, the membership of a union is diverse. And since we live in a highly segregated society in terms of where we live, the kinds of schools we go to, it's really the most diverse place we will be in. And we're there for quite a while every week. Not only is it a diverse place where people of all opinions, of various races and ethnicities and genders all work. And what is our job? What is the idea of a union? A union is not an insurance company. It's a membership organization. And therefore, it's about what we want in terms of our wages, our working conditions, our benefits. So we're concerned about the quality of our life, the security of our life, not only at our workplace, but also in our communities. So it's a very social place to be. And it's also a very democratic or potentially democratic place, where we have to listen to each other, where we get to debate and discuss and decide what our priorities are. So all of this really teaches us solidarity, not only with who are our co-workers, but other people, because we can't just be concerned about our own selves. We live in this larger world. So that sense of solidarity, that sense that we are all human, operates against the idea of fascism where only some are humans and others are subhumans. So it's really a very important institution in our society to really develop ourselves as human beings. So the potential of democracy through the unions, of course, can have a big impact not only on our jobs and our communities, but in a broader sense in our world and how we organize ourselves.
Diane, historically, the trade union movement in the United States has taken the pragmatic position of rewarding your friends and punishing your enemies. Sometimes they've supported the Democrats, therefore, and sometimes the Republicans. But what has been the result, do you think, of this pragmatism? I mean, after all, the wages of workers in America have not gone up in real terms for, 50 years? And now we see a growing fascist movement, which is enjoying historic support among many sections of the working class. So how do you assess the consequences of this traditional union pragmatism?
I think it shows how so much of what we've learned in school and in our society and even in some unions is actually wrong and not helpful to us. We are taught that, I remember in grammar school learning that if you didn't like the situation in your country, you voted out the party that was in power for the other party. That is, it was a two-party system. and also a great focus on the individual candidate rather than on the structure. What's the structure of our society and how can we make that structure better meet our needs? So in terms of the unions, I think a lot of the concessions were sold on the basis that they were absolutely necessary for our jobs. I mean, I retired as an auto worker, and I had the opportunity of debating this issue. Would it save our jobs if we accepted two-tier wages? And my argument and my organizing was, no, it did not. That in fact it would just bring more concessions. But this is what we're told, that the concessions are necessary because the auto, in this case it was the auto industry, is going through restructuring, outsourcing, or automation, and that we just had to bite the bullet until times became better. But of course they never became better because we accepted the concessions. And so we have to break out of this mold and seek a different way. And I think that's something that the UAW is trying to do now through our stand-up strike strategy that we used. So we have to develop a different perspective about how we fight for ourselves. And that includes, in my opinion, breaking with the two-party system because it does not represent our needs, as you can see in the platform of both of the parties.
Diane Feely, what's going on in the Teamsters Union? It's one of the most powerful unions in the country. The president of the Teamsters Union, Sean O'Brien, addressed the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. He spoke admiringly of Trump, calling him a tough son of a bitch. He got wild applause. The union then took a neutral position in the upcoming election, but a majority of the members of his union say they support Trump, and Trump wants to get rid of unions. How do you explain all of this?
Well, first of all, I don't think a majority of the membership of the union does support Trump, although I think probably a good portion, maybe a third or even a little bit more, supports Trump because they see him as an alternative to the neoliberal policies that have existed, that both Democrats and Republicans have carried out. It's really sad when some people who see this racist, hierarchical guy as some kind of an alternative, but I think that's really what they see. Many of them say, well, I may not agree with him on reproductive rights. I may not agree with him about this, that, or the other thing. But when he was in power, the economy was in better shape. As if the economy has very much to do with who's president of the United States in a capitalist society. So I think it just shows how badly educated we are. And I must say, there are sections of the Teamsters who have broken with the idea that Trump represents an alternative. I think the Black Caucus has a different position. I think there are other regional and local Teamsters who have different positions. Unfortunately, there really isn't the kind of alternative there should be, where there's another alternative to neoliberalism or the kind of neo-fascism that Trump represents on the ballot in all 50 states. Because, of course, the two-party system likes to perpetuate itself. And so that's the horrible situation that we're in.
You know, there's been a stirring of sorts, certainly in the labor movement. Currently, unionized workers in this country, including public sector workers, only about 11%, whereas once upon a time it was at least a third. But there's been a stirring in the movement. Amazon workers have voted to support a union. Railroad workers wanted to strike, but, well, they were prevented from doing so by the Democratic Party Biden administration. The teachers' unions in the last year, especially in West Virginia, Chicago, they've been militant. You believe that what we need is a workers' party. Currently, we barely have the nucleus of one. So, Diane, how do we get from where we are to where we have indeed a workers' party? And what might be the role of unions like those I just mentioned?
This is the big dilemma, because there are so many problems that prevent parties from emerging, whether we begin with the tremendous money that's involved and the kind of legislation that allows enormous amounts of money to prevent anything else. I see that the Green Party, even when it's been able to get all the petitions to get on the ballot, is being challenged by the Democratic Party, which just shows how undemocratic the Democratic Party is. So there are certainly all of these barriers that exist. Yet at the same time, it seems to me there's more of a sense that the two-party system is not in our interests. And therefore, kind of looking around, well, what can we do? How can we move ahead? And yet we see that the top leaders in the major unions are very wedded to the Democratic Party. So I actually think that we were set back 30 years ago when under Tony Mazzocchi, there were attempts to start a labor party, and actually 11 unions signed on, but they were afraid to move to that next step of actually beginning to run candidates. So that was a setback for us. Well, how can we move forward now where there's a greater sense that we need a party that represents us? It seems to me we've got to begin small at the local level. I know in Detroit, many of the local offices are nonpartisan offices. So I think it would be a good idea if we began to run for those nonpartisan offices, get the experience, and begin to network so that we could do this. Now, actually, the Green Party, for example, I think has something like 150 people in office, all at very local levels. So it's possible that we could begin to do this and build a much stronger network, particularly based on a union here or a union there that would be willing to begin that process. So it's a difficult struggle. And I don't have a solution at the state or national level, but I think with developing that experience at the local level, that may give us the self-confidence to move ahead.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my longtime friend and colleague, Attorney Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with Diane Feeley. Diane, some years ago, the great economist and socialist leader Ernest Mandel observed that, and this is what he said, "We're at the foot of the Himalayas without adequate tools, but we have to climb up." Would that be your assessment now?
I think so. I met Ernest Mandel a few times, and he would always ask me about the U.S. labor movement. And I would always say to him, well, we're down, but we're continuing to go down. So maybe at some point we'll be able to start moving up. So yes, I think that we have a long way to go, but we have such a great need to begin moving that I think we just have to start.
Diane, please talk about how Trump is using both race and gender in building his support, and how historically fascism used race and gender as well.
Yes, this is a very interesting question to see how race and gender are the building blocks for fascism. And it's amazing to see Trump and Vance present a kind of masculist line. I tried to avoid the debates, but at one point I turned on actually the Canadian news hoping that they wouldn't be showing the debate. And what they had was a man on there tearing his shirt off. And it turned out this was a wrestler who was speaking at the Republican Party convention. I thought this was the perfect example of a masculinist symbol. And I think everything that they say and do reinforces that they are strong and therefore they can lead. So we have Vance who talks about the cat ladies. We have Trump and Vance talking about how Haitians eat cats and dogs. So what is this all about? It's all about dehumanizing people. Their attack on trans people. All of this is to say there's two categories of people. The humans, which are us, and the subhumans. And who are the subhumans? Well, they're all the immigrants who, of course, are illegal under their definition. They're the women who really belong at home and in the house. They're the trans people. And they don't have equal rights. In fact, Vance even says it's only parents who should have extra votes. And presumably it's people who choose or are unable to have children who should have lesser rights. So this whole way of their conducting their campaign, I think, indicates the racial and gendered categories that they use. And this is something that is common, I think, to every fascist regime. If we look at the Italian government, and I think under Mussolini, it's different than under Hitler, but it's similar in terms of choosing which categories to see as human and which not to see as human. And interestingly enough, in all of these cases, the home is seen as this romantic place in which the woman is the, I guess, the queen of the home. She doesn't have any rights, but she's there as a sort of sacrificial figure. So all of this, I would say, in terms of Italy, it was the nation, the strength of the nation. In Germany, it was different. It was the strength of the master race, because even Germans who were disabled, had mental problems, were Jewish, were black, were not considered humans. So it's only the master race that can construct the nation. So all of this is pretty sick stuff. But I think it's really about the insecurity that people have in a society that is very insecure. And certainly we're facing an economic crisis now. And that was similar to the economic crisis that was happening after World War I. And certainly that had a big impact on both Germany and Italy, as well as other countries as well. And we're seeing that same kind of authoritarianism arise now as there is this economic crisis as we go into a late stage of capitalism. In fact, I call it geriatric capitalism because it's certainly at the end of its life, and yet there is no new birth that's coming into being, and that's what's creating this frustration.
Diane Feely, let's talk about Project 2025. How do you see this as helping the forces of fascism in the USA?
Well, to me, it's like it's their wish list. They have a wish list. They put forward all the things that they would like to do, not that they would be capable of doing them. And of course, I ask, well, where is our wish list? Because our wish list would be quite different from theirs. So if we look at some of the elements, we say, okay, they want to, quote, restore the family. That doesn't mean providing parental care, reducing work hours, developing a free public education that's of quality. No, it's stopping sexual orientation. It's saying that all federal laws and regulations should be stripped of any discussion of sexual orientation, gender equality, reproductive rights, saying, okay, for the Department of Health and Human Services, there should be a definition of marriage and the family, which should be biblically based. biblically based. Well, that's quite a narrow view. That federal agencies should be stripped of their regulatory capacity, and that all of this should be basically placed under the office of the presidency. So without all of the regulatory agencies and the regulatory power, what do we have left? We've lost, 75 years of regulations that are very important, whether we're talking about health and safety laws, whether we're talking about minimum wages. It's all gone. Whether we talk about the environment, it's very interesting that Trump and Vance speak a lot about the fears. They appeal to the fears of insecurity that people have. But that's usually related to the border or crime, even though crime is going down. But it's never related to the climate, which is our most severe problem. How can we live in the world without destroying our environment? Those are the things that we need regulations for, and yet that's something that's not at all considered. Now, if we take a look at what their plan, what Project 2025 plan is for the unions, they'd like to strip the unions of basically any power that we have, so that the National Labor Relations Board, which is one of the few agencies that's set up to be of help to unions, that can help organize elections to find out whether the workers at a place want a union, that would be minimized. I think Trump has said on the first day he was in office, he would fire the main person in charge, the general counsel of the NLRB, because she's too progressive. It would eliminate many of the rules that currently exist. And what it would do, and I think this is really important, is it would allow the employer to set up basically its own phony unions. And so this really takes us back really 100 years in terms of the kinds of labor legislation that we've had. Now, I think most people haven't taken a look at Project 2025. After all, it's a huge project. And as I say, it's a wish list. So even if Trump and Vance were elected, it doesn't mean it would come into being. It would be certainly, it would seem to me, that there would be many, many demonstrations and meetings and challenges, legal and on the street, to oppose that kind of wish list, but it just shows what their plan is for us and how we have to develop an alternative that's based on securing people's rights and living in a society that is a communal society and not one where everybody feels like they're in line and they better beat the other person because there's only going to be so much food or housing or jobs to go around. No, that's not That can't be our vision. Our vision must be one of solidarity, not just for our own family, but for the larger community and the larger environment in which we live.
Diane Feely, we are sadly just about out of time, but tell us about the organization, one of them to which you belong, Solidarity, and about the publication Against the Current, which you help edit.
Thank you very much for mentioning that. So people can go to the website Against the Current and see our current and back issues and get a subscription if they'd like. They can go to the Solidarity-US website and look at the articles and ideas there. And we're actually running a series of classes on fascism, taking a look at history and today. And people can register for that. So thanks very much for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us today, really, Diane Feely. Thank you.
Thanks, Diane. It's been terrific talking to you.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.